Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, my fine friends. Welcome to another Rahulastapa Book Club. Today, I'm talking to John Higgs about his fabulous book, Love and Let Die, which I hold up to the camera, even though most of you are listening to the audio. Anyone who's watching the video can see the beautiful cover. John is here. Hello, John. How are you doing?
I'm good. Hello, Richard. Nice to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you, too. I very much enjoyed this book. Tell us a bit about yourself first, who you are and what your background is. And you've written a lot of other books as well, so you could take us through a few of those as well.
Yeah, that's basically me, basically. I'm a writer. I've done nothing but write books for the last 10 years.
Amazing.
I've written books on the KLF. I've written books on William Blake. I've written books on Watling Street, on the 20th century. I've got a bit of a backlog. The back catalogue that is stacking up nicely.
Yeah, it's an incredible amount of work. In fact, in last week's show, Dan Schreiber, at the end of the show, I'll ask you to, at the end of the interview, I'll ask you to recommend any books you've been reading. And Dan, not knowing you were going to come on, recommended the KLF book, which we're not going to talk about today.
But
he waxed very lyrical, which sounds is similar in a way to this. In this book, yeah, is obviously.
It's far more nuts, the KLF. Yeah, it's quite out there, that one.
It's out there, but it's about a subject, but then the subject takes us out into the world in general, I think, is what we do with this. When I saw this book, I mean, I love books about the Beatles. I'm not as into Bond, but like every man of my generation, obviously Bond was a massive part of our childhoods because it was the major films. I've sort of lost a little bit of interest in him, but this book did ignite some of the interest and some of the questions about him. When I saw this one before I knew I was going to interview him, before I'd read it, it felt like it might be a bit like those kid books where they have dinosaur pirates or something, and someone says, "Let's take two really popular things and mash them together and see if they work." But it is more than that, I have to say. And and there is a reason. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons. What was the reason that you chose to put these two subjects together initially?
I am aware it does look quite shameless. But it was once I realised that, you know, the very first Bond film, the very first Beatles single arrived on the same day, on a Friday in October in 1962. At the moment, I just put the two things together. sort of all this sort of different perspectives on both were sort of released and revealed, and all this stuff about, you know, class and masculinity and, you know, our culture and how we've changed over the past 60 years. It all just started to sort of pour out, and it just became, I don't know, it was too good not to do. But at the same time, I'm thinking, oh, that just looks really shameless. Because at the time when I sold it to the publisher, it was called Happiness is a Warm Gun. Right? I thought, that's a cool title. And as I was writing, this voice in my head goes, it's Love and Let Die, isn't it? And I'm going, no, I can't. That's too shameless, surely. That's too obvious. And I didn't want to tell anyone that title was in my head. And I had a meeting with the publisher, and I was halfway through. I go, should I just say this? And I did, and I said it. She goes, yep, that's the title. That's the title. Oh, damn. It's like it's a pun there. But, you know, when people hear Love and Let Die about Bond and the Beatles, they kind of get what the book is. Whereas you say, I've written a book called Happiness is a Warm Gun, people are none the wiser, you know.
No, it's a good title. It's a good commercial idea. And the book is very much about the Beatles being love and Bond being death, which we'll talk about more. So, it absolutely ties the whole thing up with a ribbon. And, you know, I think it's sort of fascinating and a bit discombobulating to suddenly realize that your own lifetime is history. But that, you know, you're reading about the 1960s and thinking, yeah, of course, if I was at school, you know, that's the sort of same time distance away as World War II, which we would have studied.
And how different people were then, and how different people think, and how different culture was, and what was acceptable, how much it's changed in that period.
Yeah,
you know, and I think how little we'd fit in if we were suddenly to jump back there.
Yeah, well, you make that point about the Get Back documentary that it all feels quite modern, and then you go outside and see the people in the streets, and you go, "This is like, you know, ancient history. How are these two things like concurrent?" But that's, you know, the sixth. I mean, it's still, and as the book shows, it's still all rattling on, really, isn't it? It is so much, and it is exemplified by Bond and the Beatles, the sort of class system in England, especially, I have to say, but the United Kingdom, because we're all together in this horrible mess. You know, Ian Fleming being the kind of public school upper classes versus the Beatles being, generally speaking, a much more sort of working class phenomenon.
I think the thing that convinced me I had a book was reading a thing that Hanif Qureshi wrote about the Beatles, which is brilliant. And obviously, Hanif Qureshi, good luck, get well, and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
He'd written about when he was at school, his music teacher had taught him that the Beatles were a hoax, that there was no way, like, you know, those four lads from Liverpool could produce music that was self-evidently better than people who'd, you know, gone to the right schools and came from the right families. Yeah. It was just impossible. So clearly it was like, you know, one of the better spoken people, like, you know, like Brian Epstein or George Martin was sort of behind it. And he was taught that at school. And Qureshi, he said this really insightful thing. He says he came to realize that his music teacher had to think that, because otherwise it would take too much away. Like, his entire worldview, his sense of identity was structured on the belief that people like him were superior.
Yeah.
And then along came the Beatles, and the whole thing just became a joke, just became absolutely. And you can see the real sort of collapse in, you know, deference to the upper classes over the period of the Beatles. You know, when they start, you know, if you look at Hard Day's Night, when the bowler hatted character comes in, and he wants the window open and they want it shut, and there's four of them and stuff like that. The question of whether a character like that you were supposed to sort of, you know, tug your forelock to was still at the country at that time, still being debated. In the Bond film of that year, Goldfinger, a bowler hat is a weapon, right? It's a thing to be feared. You know, it's a dangerous sort of thing. By the end of the Beatles, the upper classes were a joke. You know, so you get like Monty Python doing the upper class twits and all that sort of thing. The whole sort of glamour around them was just sort of destroyed over that decade. And it would have happened anyway, but with the Beatles as the focus, it really happened Yeah. Really quite great song.
Although those tendrils still, you know, certainly in this decade, the tendrils of it still, you know, and there's still this element. It's interesting you say that because I had the other day, I just retweeted that bit that everyone's retweeting from Get Back of Paul McCartney creating a hit record out of nothing. Yeah. And just saying, you know, this is just amazing. And somebody really got into an argument with me about how it wasn't really all that impressive and that pop songs are pretty easy to write. And you're going to go, but yeah. You know, as any creative person watching that would go, you know, that is astonishing to see that plucked from the air. And it was just this very dismissive thing. And I wonder if there was anything of that in it, because it just seems such a joyless reaction to that. But also you kind of go, oh, if it's that easy, then why isn't everybody writing Get Back? Maybe that person
has wrote two songs that morning that we'll all be talking about in 60 years' time.
Maybe.
And they have every... I suspect not.
But there's so much to talk about. And there's so many books about the Beatles, and I've read a few of them. I'm not obsessive, but it must be hard, especially with the... I mean, both these subjects, it must have been difficult for you to... And I think you've succeeded in doing this, but to find... new stuff or to find a new spin on the stuff, at least because they have been, as you say, like John Lennon's entire life has been covered in film. There's books that cover every day of the Beatles existence.
I think there's around 2000 books about the Beatles.
Right.
We're still hungry for more. It's kind of like, you know how A Christmas Carol is a story that's so good you can't do it wrong.
Yeah.
And every time you do it in a different way, it's still really good. The Beatles story is as a story, let alone you know their body of work, and let alone what they created, just the relationships and the characters and what happened to them in that really intense 8-year period is such a modern myth. And we understand the music industry via how they set up our concepts of studios, our concepts of how bands fall apart, you know, how bands are supposed to be. There's so much of the way we just think is normal that just comes from this group of four people. It has sort of become a little bit of a foundational myth for modern Britain, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's always, you know, I think it is. I'm sort of endlessly fascinated by it. I read Craig Brown's book last year, which I loved as well. And I loved the way he did that. But so much came out of that. I'm sort of obsessed from his books to take a detour for a second. We'll get back to you in a second with the story of coming back from Hamburg and the Beatles take a little bit of a break and Paul McCartney goes back to work and he's offered a manager job. And has to choose between the two. And I'm very, very much obsessed with the idea of Paul McCartney choosing the sensible option and not doing the band. Oh, how different the world would be if he'd made that choice. But
all four of them had that choice at one point around that time where there was the sensible thing that they should do or the Beatles. And all four of them, you know, made the what we'd see at the time as the daft choice.
Yeah. It's difficult to think. I mean, as this book points out, it's difficult to think of something with more cultural significance, probably than both of these things. But, you know, if the Beatles had never existed, obviously something else would have filled that gap. But it would, you know, the world would be remarkably different. And I think as this book shows, that whether it was the catalyst or the impetus behind many changes in life, the Beatles were right there.
Yeah, and as we get sort of further and further away from them and we get more and more perspective on them, they just get bigger. They just seem to get bigger and bigger. And it's kind of like, you know how, you know, Shakespeare is bigger than 16th century theatre, like the footprint of Shakespeare is bigger. The Beatles have seemed to become bigger than, you know, 1960s pop music. It wasn't that long ago that people would talk about the Beatles and the Stones as if, you know, they were in some way equivalent or similar sort of thing. You don't get that anymore. Now it's if you go on Google and ask you about United Kingdom, it puts up this fact box. And in the second sentence, it goes Shakespeare and the Beatles. You know, before Jane Austen, before Charles Darwin, before, you know, Churchill or anything like that. Shakespeare and the Beatles is how we as a country have sort of come to present ourselves and define ourselves.
Yeah, it is. And Ian Fleming, who I didn't know a huge amount about, turns out to be. I've written in my notes, he's a rum one, is my polite way of putting it.
Yeah.
But he does sort of exemplify that pre-60s. Obviously, the books were he started writing in the 50s or so. So it was something around there, wasn't it? So that's it sort of exemplifies that pre-60s and that post-war thing where the UK is trying to pretend it's still got an equal footing in the world and that its Secret Service matters. But he's... I mean, I suppose what's interesting about or nearly everyone in this book is they had a troubled childhood of some kind, you know, with tragedy or with difficulties. And Ian Fleming's childhood, which again, I think it speaks, and this has come up a bit in Rahulastapur, we're talking about various politicians of the modern day, the sort of boarding school lack of love that the public school children got.
Yeah.
And the kind of repercussions that's had on their adult lives and the way they view love and other human beings. Ian Fleming's quite an unpleasant man, and that's why Bond is as he is.
Yeah, he didn't come out of it well. And if you read Anne in a book like Goldfinger in particular, is one that if you read it in the 2020s, you're wincing. You know, there's a lot in the novels in particular that it's kind of shocking. You know, now these days, but. Fleming is interesting because it was a similar thing to John Lennon. You're right. Almost everyone in this story, you know, lost parents or were, you know, brought up outside a nuclear family or were sort of sent away to nannies or anything like that. Yeah. Only about George Martin and George Harrison are the only people sort of happily raised by their own parents. Everybody else, there was, you know, some strange situation. But it's a thing more about being sent away. For your own good, right? Being sent away by your parents, which John Lennon had, and of course all the people who were sent to boarding school had, that seems to damage people more than actually losing a parent. You know, Paul McCartney lost his mum, and John Lennon lost his mum, but because John Lennon had been sent away before he lost his mum, he never really got over it, and he was still trying to work through it to that day. And it does seem to be damaged by that in a similar way to Ian Fleming, who was sent away to boarding school and then lost his parent. There's a lot of interesting sort of connections sort of going on between them.
Sure. And I think with Fleming, the point you make, which I think is a very interesting and kind of horrific one, is obviously Bond is an avatar of what he would like to be.
Yeah.
And the kind of emotional detachment from women, in that you sort of speculate that Fleming wanted to have sex with women and for them to go away. And his solution for that, is something that he's not the only man in the world that would think that. But his solution, with Bond was to basically have anyone that James Bond sleeps with dies, which is quite an extreme solution to that problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look throughout the history of the Bond films coming out, this every time there's a film, they announce it's a new type of Bond woman, right? It's not like all the other, you know, ones from the past, which we're a bit ashamed of, as if it wasn't the same producers who'd made all these films. This is a new type of Bond woman. And then in the next film, they're like, don't worry, this is a new type of Bond woman. They have to do it every sort of single time. And there sort of comes a point where you have to go, well, maybe the problem's not actually the women. Maybe the problem is Bond. And maybe the whole he sleeps with people and they die is the sort of issue. So that's what makes where Bond's got to now fascinating. You know, I don't know if I'm allowed to sort of spoil, you know, No Time to Die.
With a spoiler.
Well, he dies. but the way it's done, it's that the whole issue of that he sleeps with women and they die is moved to the level of plot. For the first time, it's on a story level. It's this complicated thing about there's some nanobots and they're genetically programmed so that if James Bond is to touch the woman that he loves, she will die. And he's a hero, so what can he do? The only thing he can do is sort of sacrifice himself. He has to die at the end of that film because the flaw inherent in his character, you know, has become aware. His shadow, his darkness, has become sort of visible. It's fascinating what they did with that film, to me anyway. I think it's extraordinary, but it was quite a shock for, you know, most people who'd been through some really, you know, harrowing years with the lockdown and everything that had been going on, and the one sort of comfort, you know, is, oh, you can go to the cinema and, like, you'll see James Bond and, like, everything will be fine and he'll just sort of win. To see, you know, that sort of white male avatar just being wiped out was just sort of such a shock to so many people.
That's interesting to me that, you know, that it's interesting to me that Bond has managed to survive all these years despite being such a relic from the past. But, I mean, there's a sort of truth about a certain type of masculinity in there that I think keeps his largely male audience, I think, invested in it. But it's interesting how, for example, how little of the Beatles you listen back to and go, ooh, you know, given it's from the 1960s. I mean, there's a couple of bits that, and I think you point out the John Lennon song, "You Better Run for Your Life, Little Girl," is a pretty, pretty terrifying song. Although it's still a song that's about, you know, it's about something that's real and it's horrible, but the person singing it's horrible, and so it's sort of artistically maybe valid, even though it's quite a difficult listen. But I guess because they were writing about love and they were writing about things that are fairly universal. And they were, and as you say, they're a very different kind of masculinity. Very little of it needs re-looking at.
It is remarkable, considering how much work they did, and you know, how much that work has been studied. We've got, you know, it could have been much worse than definitely John Lennon. But Lennon's interesting because he's very much the flawed healer, I guess you'd call it, that sort of archetype. It's you know, he's in a bad place. He's from a bad background. He comes from this sort of, he's got a very sort of violent sort of culture around him, and he wants to get better. And it's about attempting to sort of get better, which is the only thing you can do if you're in a bad position.
Yeah,
all you can do is try and improve and head towards the light and become better. And he never really quite manages it, but it's the fact that he's trying to do it which makes him kind of so reliable, well, important and necessary. And when, like, the Lennon estate tries to present him as a saint, you know, the peace icon, Saint John, it ruins him slightly because that's lesser than what he was. You know, the flaws and all thing about Lennon is important because we are all flawed, you know, and we all need to sort of see our shadow, see our sort of dark side, and try and improve ourselves. And in some ways, that's what's interesting about Bond is that, you know, Bond has this really odd way of just sort of saying to its audience, well, you'd like to be me, wouldn't you? Well, you'd like my life a little bit. You know, no one fantasizes about sort of being Jason Bourne. Bond is not what men should be or what men need to be, sort of what men want to be. And so it's never going to be, you know, ideologically pure or easy to define. But by putting it out into the light like that, I think that is a thing we do need to do. We do need to explore those things. And you can see the character sort of shift over the decades. He changes an awful lot. Yeah. You know, he's not like how he was in the books. He's not like Sean Connery, who, you know, was a real sort of no means yes. You know, there's a real sort of consent issue in a lot of things. And then it moves into the 70s and that improves, but there's all this chauvinism. And women drivers remarks and all this sort of thing with Roger Moore. And then you get, you know, Timothy Dalton and he's much more asexual and that's not right. And so you can sort of see the character sort of shifting and changing over the years as this sort of idealized representation of, you know, what men sort of want to be. And overall, it's a positive thing. You know, it really has moved quite a bit to the extent that, you know, the Daily Mail, you know, for the last Daniel Craig film, the word woke, you know, wasn't sufficient for them, and that they formed the word super woke, you know, to describe Daniel Craig. And all the, you know, the Daily Telegraph writers writing furious articles about the fact he turned up in like a pink jacket for the premiere, you know, all this sort of stuff's going on. The change when you see it laid out is striking, and you know, it is good the way it's changed for all no one's going to defend Bond as, you know.
It is sort of, you know, often people go, well, this someone was like this in the past, so, you know, they're doomed forever. But if I think with John Lennon, it's a good example, though, like you say, it is very complicated with John Lennon because he said certain things that he was living an opposite, like, you know, just in terms of having no possessions when he had a lot of possessions, for example.
He had a lot of possessions.
But he moved in the, you know, very much in the right direction from his early life and his and that's what you want. I got a feel with Bond. You mentioned Tarzan, which I think's interesting, and how Tarzan, when we were growing up, Tarzan, and even into the 90s, really, Tarzan was a huge thing and it was a huge story. And now, you know, you couldn't really get arrested if you tried to bring. I don't think you could even do Tarzan in a tongue-in-cheek, ironic way. Really, I mean, it's sort of gone.
The heart of the story of Tarzan is if you take, you know, an upper-class white lord as a baby and put them in the jungle, they will become king of that jungle because they're best. They're, you know, innately superior. There's no way, you know, we can live with that anymore. We're not. No one's going to go for that in any way, shape. And it's quite interesting that when they first changed Bond, when Sean Connery moved on, Cubby Broccoli would do all these interviews and we'd say, no, Bond is a character that you can continually, you know, recast and reinvent. He's like Sherlock Holmes and Tarzan, you know. Any actor can sort of play him. And, you know, with Sherlock Holmes, that's fine. That sort of continued. But the question of now whether Bond is more like Tarzan and his innate flaws are too much for the 21st century is quite an interesting one. And it's going to be very interesting to see where they go with the next film. And they're taking a long time. You know, they finished the last one in like 2019 and they're still not, you know, it's odd that they haven't like recast and got a film out. Because it's going to be the first millennial Bond, right? So they're going to be around the age of 30 or something. They're going to be a millennial. And, you know, the idealized vision of masculinity for someone of that age is, it's probably someone like Harry Styles, right? But if you were to cast Harry Styles as James Bond, you can imagine how the internet and the Fleet Street would just utterly lose their minds over it. So it's tempting to say, oh, it will be like Tarzan and it's out of date. But people have been saying that for decades. They've been saying that from about 1967. And the thing with James Bond is the Beatles, neither of them make any sense. Neither of them are utterly implausible. The idea that you can like make an action film based on one character and then go on and make, you know, 25 sequels, you know, over 60 years, each of one which makes money, each of one is richly successful. It's just impossible. Right? You can't do it. Yeah. If you could do that, every Hollywood producer would be doing it. You know, there'd be nothing there. It's insane, right?
Yeah.
And if it wasn't the fact it was so familiar to us and we're so used to it, you know, we'd just go, no, there's no possible way. That's just really. So there is something about the way Bond has become a tradition and become trapped in the establishment, which is a powerful magic tradition that means he sort of keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. So I'm not quite, you know, of the view that, there's not going to be any more Bond. It's out of date anymore. There's something about the way he keeps going that I find really fascinating.
I agree, but it's sort of the equally weird thing about it is I think he has to have one foot in the past for it to work. So it's like you say, well, in the first film, he's slagging off the Beatles and, you know, they made the decision with George Lazenby, are we going to give him long hair? And no, we won't give him long hair.
Yeah.
So, you know, he sort of represents something in the past.
Yeah.
And yet you're still sort of trying to stretch him into the future at the same time.
Absolutely. You know, he's still an establishment killer, you know.
Yeah.
he's got permission, he's got the paperwork, he's got the license to kill from the Queen, you know. So he can't, that's sort of what traps him in the past. That's how he sort of changes and deals with that is what's interesting.
Yeah, and it's fascinating as well, the point you make about Q, that he's basically an arms manufacturer. Yeah. His job is to kill lots of people, and yet he's seen as this kind of, you know, you all love that character.
Absolutely.
Whoever plays him, really, but especially Desmond Llewellyn. And
I felt a bit bad writing that, because I knew a lot of people would be going, oh, God, I can't. I love Desmond Llewellyn, and now I can't see him in the same way anymore. But, hey...
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I mean, there's a lot to talk about in this book, and we're not going to be able to talk about all of it. I think it's a very interesting look at our own history and our social history about trying to identify both what it means to be a man and what it means to be British, and this sort of swirling mist on both of those things over the last 60 years that we haven't really come to any conclusion about. I mean, there's lovely little, little moments. I didn't know this thing, the way they tested whether George Lazenby was going to be a suitable Bond in a very old-fashioned way is worth it. Can you tell us about how they made sure George Lazenby was the right person to be Bond?
Yeah, I don't think they do that nowadays. I don't think they did this with, Daniel Craig. Well, you'd have to ask Daniel Craig.
We'll ask him.
The producers sent a couple of prostitutes to his room and stayed to watch, right, to check that he wasn't gay.
I mean, there's so much to unpack in that. I mean, just that it mattered, that it would have mattered, that was the way to test it. And then better sit and watch. You could just ask them afterwards.
Homosexuality was still illegal at that point. It was just about to change at the exact same point. And now, in like Skyfall, James Bond makes references to, or hints at homosexual experiences in the past, and no one bats a lie. It's another example of just the size of the change we've had.
Yeah, it's great. And I didn't know much about George Lazenby's Bond. I think I have seen that. I definitely have seen the film, but I didn't realize it was. I thought he'd been sort of pushed out for not being as Sean Connery enough. But in fact, he turned down the opportunity.
He did, but they were clearly, there was beef. They were clearly wasn't getting on. And the whole thing about how he was told not to turn up at the Leicester Square premiere because he'd grown his hair sort of George Best sort of length and had a beard. It seems shocking now. He turned up anyway and got into a huge argument with Kirby Broccoli and was not allowed to go to America because of this. But he doesn't look like a crazy hairy man. The idea that an actor can have different hair than on screen and off, it's not a problem. But it's just an indicator of where the culture wars were at the time. Because there's always been culture wars. And the issue of hair on men was such a divisive thing at that sort of point. And, the Broccolis wanted nothing to do with sort of long-haired sort of men. They were on the other side of this sort of divide. And it's a nice indication of when there are these culture war issues. A, they always look utterly absurd a few years later. But B, they're never really quite about what we say they're about. There's much larger sort of changes and shifts sort of going on in underneath in the sort of cultural world, and it's just the little sort of excuse that pops up, like long hair on men, is the thing that sort of gets the focus. But they really, they represent a much larger sort of change that's occurring. And, you know, George Lazenby, one of the reasons he sort of gave it up was because he just thought it was over. It was dead, you know. It was make peace not love. He was kept himself to himself on set, trying to learn Beatles songs on his guitar, you know. And it was the Beatles world then. The Beatles had changed everything and everything had won. And he thought, you know, an establishment killer in a dinner jacket, for God's sake, you know, we don't want anything to do with that. It's all over. I'll sort of walk away. Not knowing that at that point, you know, it was the Beatles that were about to die.
Yeah.
James Bond was just going to keep going and keep going and keep going.
Yeah, I thought there was a slight echo of the man who turned down the Beatles with George Lazenby, the man who turned down Bond because of the Beatles. It's the same, you know, he obviously would look back on that with some regrets later in his life.
He did at some point in the 70s when he had children and no work. He did he came to the conclusion it was probably a bad move to turn down that £1 million signing fee in the 7 films that had been offered.
There we go. You touch on one of my favorite subjects, but I think equally this is again a thing that sort of started it in with, not started this point, but was a minor thing in the conspiracy theories about the death of Paul. It's obviously become turned into a much bigger issue, but you're fairly dismissive, correctly, of the chances when you look at that, the get back and see the fake Paul creating music better than the original Paul would have made. You kind of think that was a good substitution.
It was a great bit of casting, wasn't it? How they found that fake Paul. Yeah, but it was interesting that those stories had been bubbling around for a few years, but they really came to the forefront at that period in 1969, sort of when the Beatles kind of had split up, but they sort of, you know, it wasn't clear whether John was going to change his mind, and it would, you know, it was this weird period where the Beatles split up, but nobody knew. And the problem was sort of, as John would see it, was that the Beatles become Paul and his sidekicks, you know, it becomes so much the Paul McCartney show. So it's like Paul was the Beatles. And so the fact that the world gets obsessed with the idea that Paul is dead at the point when Paul is the Beatles and the Beatles are dead is kind of weird.
Yeah.
You know, Paul was having a real breakdown at this time. He was in a really bad place, and it was really fortunate that he had Linda to sort of get him through it. It's almost like the world sort of picked up on his distress in some way.
Yeah.
The Paul is dead, you know, saga, it's fun. I mean, we all like it. It's all great. But there is, the timing of it is really interesting, I think.
Yeah, and whether that leads to QAnon, you know, there is still, if you go online, there are still people vehemently arguing that, despite the, you know, the evidence coming out that it was all like, it's basically an American student radio hoax or something like that, a radio hoax, isn't it? And so all the evidence is there, but you can't convince them. There are people comparing the ears of the pre and post Paul McCartney. Like nobody would have gone, you look so much like Paul McCartney. And then you just disappeared. And no one went, oh, well, you know, I suppose he just went. It's a bit weird. But yes, but anyway, that's interesting.
Whereas if John, because Paul, you know, was Paul, but John did change so drastically, you know, around Rishikesh, all the humour dropped out of him. He became so serious. You know, if people had said it's a different actor being John Lennon, you could see people sort of going for that. But with Paul, it's just mad. You know,
and the point you make about the bed, the love in the bed where it says hair piece, and there isn't a joke about hair piece, which in the 1960s, John would absolutely have been all over that. So it's, you know, and he obviously didn't even spot it, or if he did, he left it. I mean, it's nice to have the reevaluation of Paul, which has sort of, I mean, you explained that really well, how John came to be seen the cool one and Paul McCartney became naff. But Paul McCartney became naff at the sort of the same time as Bond. You know, it's kind of interesting you mentioned Alan Partridge, because Alan Partridge preferred Wings to the Beatles and was obsessed with sort of basically Roger Moore Bond. So those two sort of 1970s iterations of both were sort of naff enough, or seen as naff enough at the time for someone like Alan Partridge to think they're amazing. But it is so interesting how, you know, Paul McCartney's was both blamed for the breakup of the Beatles and how his subsequent work, apart from, you know, Live and Let Die, was sort of pilloried at the time, when it is quite respected now.
Yeah, I mean, time's been very, very kind to Paul McCartney.
And, yeah.
Well, at times also extremely cruel. You know, in the sort of the me decade, when we sort of like, we looked up to these sort of lion-eyed sort of rock gods who, you know, drank and slept with everything and, you know, just were complete libertines. Now, you know, we look at them and we go, oh, they're bad ones, them, aren't they? They're not good. But all the time was going, it's about, you know, love, it's about family, it's about home, it's about all these things. The naffest possible sort of attitude, you know, say in the 80s or something like that. And it holds up sort of really well. There's you going, oh, we should be vegetarian, you know. People just going, oh, God's sake, that's the worst thing now, thanks to climate change and Linda McCartney's company and all these sort of things.
Yeah.
He just, you know, it's quite interesting trying to explain to someone from Generation Z how naff Paul McCartney used to be seen.
Yeah.
Because they're really confused by it. They're really bewildered by it. They'll dismiss John Lennon quite quickly. But, you know, Paul McCartney, surely he wrote all these extraordinary songs. You know, what's the problem?
It is sort of interesting. I mean, I'm desperate to get Paul McCartney on Rahalastapur, which I've come closer than I imagined I would. He did do Adam Buxton's podcast.
But
it's not an impossibility, but it really is like, you know, the opportunity to talk to someone who will be almost certainly a thousand years time, people will know who you're talking about. Or 500 years time, whatever.
How do you live with that knowledge? Because he does know. He does know how important the Beatles are. He is quite big.
Yeah.
How big they are. You know, he's walking around amongst all these people who will be forgotten. You know, once their grandchildren have died, everyone will sort of be forgotten. He is a chapter in the history books.
Yeah.
You know, you could so easily turn into a monster. Surely the temptation to turn into a monster would be too great. And that's why this sort of forced, jolly everyman persona that can wind people up and, you know, because it's like, you're not everyman, you're Paul McCartney, for God's sake. This is something insincere and fake about your everymanness sort of thing. It probably is the wisest thing he could have done, you know, because he is living, you know, a happy, good life, despite, you know, the fact of who he is and the enormity of what he's done.
Yeah. And, you know, I was just listening to Matthew Perry's audiobook, which is obviously also about becoming, wanting to be the most famous person in the world and sort of becoming the most famous person in the world and then failing to cope with it. And he doesn't come out well from his own book. You know, it's very sad. And he doesn't seem hugely self-aware. And he's sort of full of himself and yet empty of himself at the same time. It's worth, I think I've talked to, maybe I talked to Dan about that in the last week's episode, but it's worth having a read or a listen. But yeah, that is remarkable that Paul obviously had moments where he was, where things went wrong and where he was down and made some questionable choices about wives, perhaps, or one wife at least. but you know, he has, yeah, I mean, it must be such a difficult thing to cope with that level of fame and still come out relatively, I mean, not end up in an emergency room about to die from. Maybe they were lucky, or maybe he was lucky that he went sort of down the pot route rather than the heroin route. But
because they were wild shaggers in the 60s. You know, they were not faithful. He was not faithful to Jane Asher for, you know, more than a minute. You know, he was a real sort of libertine until he got married, and this until, you know, he had Linda's daughter Heather to look after. This the sort of change that came over him was really quite extraordinary. He could so easily have, there's so many other examples of how to go wrong as a rock star.
But, you know, and it's also in the 60s and the 70s where literally anything, you know, and you do hear stories about other rock stars where they pushed it so far and, you know, into terrible areas. But it's, you know, it was, in terms of just being a hedonist, that was the dream time to be a hedonist. And to come out of that without turning into James Bond and turning into a cult, you know, to still be capable of loving someone, I think is really interesting, but to not turn unpleasant, not become arrogant. You know, I mean, again, you see it now with footballers. People get to this level and, you know, and stars, they get to a level where they think they're untouchable and become, you know, and believe that everyone loves them and wants them. And then that can lead to some terrible places. So, yeah.
Whereas it's George, the most spiritual of the Beatles. He's the one into the fast cars. He's the one into the womanizing. He's the most Bond-like on that sort of, you know, level.
But it must have been fun to, I mean, some of the links I think are very, very interesting. Some of them are a little more fun and tenuous. I mean, Spectre and Spectre is a kind of, is a fun thing to spot Phil Spectre. But it does sort of add up. But did you find as you were going along, they were all of these sort of coincidences and these connections were just falling into your lap or were you forcing
it? And, you know, a lot of them are just funny, you know, they don't mean anything, they're just funny. A lot of them, others, you just go, I just love the fact that of all the people to end up with the Bond girl, it was Ringo, you know, he married Barbara Bach, the spy who loved me. A lot of them are really sort of nice. But because, the footprint of both things was so huge, they just overlap constantly, all the time, you know. Obviously, Paul McCartney recording the theme song to Love and Let Die, Live and Let Die, being an obvious sort of one. But it sort of gave me excuses to write about people like Christopher Lee.
Yeah, I was going to say,
who was Scaramanga at the same time as he was on the cover of the Wings album and things like that. That sort of tied in with visions of, you know, idealized male lives and things like that, and finding a crossover between them, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a generally great book. It's really interesting to go over the history of both the projects, but also of where we're at. And I think it's as a country and as men, I think those things are really fascinating. And I think just the shadow of that public school boarding school sort of disaster hanging over our politics and the damage it's done in the last 10 years is very interesting. I think there's a book which might be good for you, the kind of thing you do. I can't do it because I'm involved. I'm one of the characters in it. In the mid-1980s to late 1980s, in the Oxford Union, people like Cameron and Boris Johnson and Michael Gove were upstairs debating politics in the Oxford Union, whilst downstairs in the tiny jazz cellar at the Oxford Union, Stuart Lee, Armando Iannucci, Al Murray, Sally Phillips, this whole sort of cast of comedians who were going to go on to push the entertainment industry in one way and the politicians upstairs pushing the country in a different way. I just think there's sort of there's an interesting play or book or story, I think, in that kind of divide. And we were, you know, and it was like being actually the guy who set up Tony Brennan died unfortunately at his funeral. I gave a speech about him, and I pointed out it was like we were Guy Fawkes, you know, underneath, literally in a cellar underneath. And it might have been better if we'd rather than doing jokes, we'd just put a load of gunpowder down there to take out a generation of politicians. But it is fascinating when you do, you know, I think it's a fascinating thing to do, to take, to take a situation like this that you've done with this book and extrapolate it and see all of the way that those tendrils sort of meet together and bump against each other. And, you know, I sort of feel the country, maybe I'm wrong, the country might have been better had the people downstairs run the country and the people upstairs become comedians, which they sort of, I think it's something like Armando, and, you know, everything Armando's done, it almost feels like, you know, it's sort of the reverse, especially with all his political stuff. So I think that's all interesting, but, you know, that's by the by. look, it's a great book. I've massively enjoyed it. It's called Love and Let Die. John Higgs is the author we've been talking to. Absolutely fantastic. I ask every week. Oh, you do the, and also before we get on to that, you do the audio book yourself, which is you're a very listenable and fantastic broadcaster. Have you got broadcasting experience in the past? Because it was very, you know, sometimes an author is advised not to read their own books, or sometimes you wish they hadn't read their own book. Mostly I like it when the author does read their own books, but it is quite a difficult skill to do that reading, isn't it?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I've done a lot of them now. I do all my own books, and it's such a big part. I mean, the amount of people I meet who can't like, I can't read a book, but I listen to all your books. Yeah. And the amount of people I meet, especially couples who will come up to me after a talk and go, oh, we listen to you in bed at night. And then the, a little pause when, as if they sort of realize that they've said something they shouldn't, like that was too intimate. They shouldn't have given that sort of away.
Do you enjoy the process of doing that? Or is, I mean, it's kind of quite, I mean, your books are hefty as well, so it must take you a while to get through all of it.
Yeah, it's not the most fun part of the job, no. But it's an important part of the job, you know. So.
It is. Well, it really works as an audiobook, which not all, I don't think all books are great as audiobooks, but this one is very engaging, and you do, you know, I judge it by how many times I have to press the, go back 30 seconds to miss something, because... Well, in a way, sometimes a very interesting book can make you start thinking about something else, and then you have to go back. And sometimes you just drift off thinking about something else. But I was very engaged. I've actually listened to this one very, very quickly in a few days. So it's a great audio book. It's also a great book. I ask everyone if they are reading anything at the moment that they would like to recommend. You were recommended last week.
I have just read something that is absolutely brilliant. It's not actually out yet. I think
that's fine.
It's probably out in a couple of months. It's a book called Man Eating Typewriter by Richard Millward, and it's written entirely in Polari.
Right.
The sort of secret gay language of the 1950s, people who know Kenneth Williams will be familiar with some Polari. So you're reading this book, and your brain is trying to sort of teach itself Polari as you go along to sort of. Which you do really brilliantly. So by the end of the book, you're really quite fluent in Polari. But it's so outrageous. It's kind of like, it's like if Clockwork Orange had been adapted by John Waters at his most sort of, you know, out there.
Yeah.
It's such a lark. It's so fun. It's so out of order, right? This book. It's about a guy who's sending chapter of his life story to a publisher on the grounds that he's going to do the most fantastic, most shocking, most awful crime in a couple of months' time, and he'll probably die, so they might want to sort of publish the book. And at the end of the book, it sort of reveals itself to be this this perfectly structured murder mystery, like really cleverly done. Right. You're having such a good time with this sort of outrageous Polari sort of madness throughout the whole thing. But you never really noticed that's what the book was. And
fantastic.
So at the end of the book, you're like, oh, that's great. Yeah, that's really good. So I love that. That's a book called Man-Eating Typewriter.
Okay,
Richard
great.
Millward.
Well, I will check it out. And I presume you're working on something else yourself. Are you able to
give
any details of what the next one will be?
I'm working about four things at the moment. It's getting a bit mad. I'm doing a 10th anniversary fancy hardback edition of the KLF book, which is going to be an author's commentary edition. I basically go back to it after 10 years and put in like a load of footnotes. I've written about 13,000 words of footnotes, looking back after it with hindsight and thinking, oh, Jesus Christ, what was that about? Where's this? It's like a director's commentary on a DVD.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing.
Oh, that's good.
It's mad that book. I mean, that book was originally, I self-published it as an ebook.
Okay.
And then it got picked up and came out as a paperback. And like, you know, 10 years later, it's coming out as a hardback. So it's the whole thing's the wrong way around. The whole thing is just sort of very
well, that's
sort of
very good for any writers listening to know that it does work and that you can, because I often do talk about how authors got into publishing, because it's obviously very difficult to get published. That does happen, but not very often. So that's a great thing that it can happen.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't be a writer now if, you know, Amazon hadn't invented Kindles and their ebook sort of system. And it was just at that point when it was sort of coming through that I thought, oh, I could not, no one's interested in the KLF, but I am. I could just write it and put it out and then I'll sort of move on. And not knowing that, you know, 10 years later, people would still be talking to me about that book every bloody day.
There you go. Well, the downside of this podcast is that I have to read a book every week, and it's when I discover an author I like who's got loads of books out. I can't immediately go back and read them all, but I will try, and maybe when the new version of the KLF book comes out, that might be an excuse to read that.
Well, I read all the audio books, so if you need something to fall asleep to,
okay,
I'm your man.
So, something to spice up my evening times with my wife. What I've taken it from this, if we listen to audiobooks in bed, then it can lead to some exciting places. That's my understanding.
It'll be a beautiful thing, Richard. I'm looking forward to those evenings.
I'll let you know. I'll let you, like George Lazenby style, I'll let you come and watch to see if it's worked. Right, look, it's lovely to talk to you, John.
You say that to all your guests.
Thank you very much. I don't know who's on next week, but thanks to Chris Evans, not that one, and Ben Evans, not that one, for all their help with this podcast. And thank you to John Higgs. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.